Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to UFO Think Tank with your host, Alejandro Rojas.
Yo, peeps, just like to say that some of you, you know, it's not easy to detect because I am so, you know, come across so worldly and professional. I'm actually from the ghetto, people, you know, the ghettos of Denver. If you know what Globe Village, you know what I'm talking about, but just come a long way. But hey, speaking of, it's been a while, you know, we didn't talk since last Friday, and I'm super happy to be back on track with the show. I'm really happy that we've got UFOnaut back also. Jesse was missed, so he does his show on Blog Talk on Sundays, and he's got a great thing going on there. So it's another just fabulous weekend. I've got my screen door open because the weather is just incredible out here. My dog goes a little more crazy because she likes to bark at people outside. So you may hear Tessa the Chihuahua protecting our household behind us here periodically, but that's just her doing her thing. But welcome to the show. We've got a wonderful show today. Next week, I'm going to have Jeff Peckman. He's the guy doing the Denver ballot initiative to have an extraterrestrial affairs committee here in Denver, in Denver County. So we'll talk to him. He was on David Letterman and stuff like that. And he suggested someone. And actually, I've seen her, Niara, on, and I hope I'm saying that right, Niara Isley on Examiner.com, because many of you know that I have the Denver Paranormal Science Examiner blog on Examiner.com. Niara also has an Examiner blog. We'll have her talk about that. Jeff Peckman is the Denver UFO Examiner. And I talk often about Roger Marsh, who is the National UFO Examiner. And I'll be talking more about him as well. But Niara, this is a great story because she was in the U.S. Air Force and she had a period of time, and we'll get more details about this, where she couldn't remember her memories. Later, years later, outside the Air Force, she did some regressions, and she found some extraterrestrial activity had happened during that time, as long as the Air Force. So what are these guys up to? Jesse, I know on UFOnaut recently had someone with similar experiences. Oh, there she goes. With similar experiences that she had shared on his show. So we'll put two and two together here and hopefully start to figure out what the heck is going on. But before we start, I know Niara's on the line waiting patiently, but let me get over, do some UFO news here real quick. Uh-oh, get out of my Facebook. If you're not a Facebook friend of mine, feel free, if you have Facebook, look for UFO Think Tank on Facebook. I love getting new friends all the time, and I've got some great ones out there. So it's always fun to converse and talk back and forth. It's some great technology. Speaking of Roger Marsh, though, the Denver or the National UFO Examiner, he's been posting a lot of files from MUFON. So whenever he gets, he checks MUFON, the CMS database, on a regular basis. And remember, all of this, the public can watch. In fact, we have something called the UFO Stalker, which is this graphical thing where you can see when, at real time, those sighting reports come in, and then you can read those reports. So he's got a UFO traffic report, because we've got a lot of traffic up there, as some of you know. But he talks about UFOs, drop diamond shop-shaped objects. So he's mostly talking about actually something we'll talk about later, but this is a different case, actually, in Colorado, where something fell out of what somebody saw, a UFO. And he also is talking about a Minnesota UFO case. All of these, remember, if you go to UFOthinktank.com, on the front page, on the bottom, you'll have links to all of these stories. So go check it out. Or you can subscribe by going to Yahoo Groups, looking up UFO Think Tank, and you can subscribe so you can get all of these in your email so you can be up to date with the latest and greatest. And this next story is the reason I kind of stumbled over the last one, because there's another case. If you watch UFO Handlers, you saw this recently, Bob White. This is a guy who is in Colorado in Grand Junction when he saw a UFO, and he saw something fall out of this UFO. He recovered it, and it was a teardrop-shaped object, kind of feathered on the side, and it's made up of mostly aluminum. There's a lot of interesting things about this, and if you watch the UFO Hunters program, you saw how a lot of researchers have found this to be interesting, because there were some scientists on that show that said they don't understand the configuration of this aluminum, and it does seem to be otherworldly. And now these universities are looking into it, and hopefully UFO Hunters will have a follow-up. But another interesting part of this is John Greenwald does Black Vault. If you go to his site, John Greenwald's cool. We definitely got to get him on the show. When he was in high school, he started doing Freedom of Information Act requests to the CIA, the Army, everybody, for UFO info. And he's got the biggest database on UFO files that have been released. And you can go to the blackvault.com and read some of these. But in his files, in an Army file, he found a paper where in Denmark, these Army officials went to look, that somebody had said in Denmark that they saw a UFO, they saw something fall out of it, and the picture looks exactly like the Bob White object. And in fact, on the UFO Hunters episode, which I just watched actually a few hours ago, I DVR those shows, they showed that picture, but they didn't reference it. They didn't say what it was. But if you watch the show again, you'll see this photocopy that they have of a tear-shaped object that looks just like the Bob White object. That's what that is, an old Army report from something like the 60s. So the same object. So that's another interesting thing about this Bob White object. But it's a great story, and someone actually on UFO Digest, L.A. Marzulli, you know, one of the writers there, wrote a great article about this also, just about the incredible discoveries, and his articles called UFO Encounters, Heads in the Sand. And he just kind of talks about the weird state that people are in, and I'm sure many of you can relate, how there's all of this evidence out there. There are these scientists looking into these pieces, these artifacts that have been recovered. But so many people just kind of bury their head in the sand. They ignore it, and they just don't want to look at it. And I know some of you enthusiasts have probably tried to talk to some of your friends and coworkers about this subject. Now, I find, and I think if you're afraid of talking with your family and friends and coworkers about this, I find more people are open to this subject than I expect. And maybe I'm a little cynical that way, but it always surprises me when I have some coworker come to me and they're like, hey, you know, I saw you on TV and I didn't know you were into UFOs. I had my own sighting, and they share their own experiences. Because you're afraid of those people that are just going to kind of look at you funny. And no doubt I've had that situation happen as well. But you'll be surprised in how many people do talk about their sightings and know what's going on. But there are those people who just don't want to hear it. You mention something to them, maybe they even say, I saw something weird once, but I don't think it was a UFO. And then you ask them about it, and there's been times I've had that happen, and it's an extraordinary sighting, and you're like, well, what do you think that giant disc that was lit up like a Christmas tree that floated 50 feet over your car and then shot off at speeds that, you know, nothing else could fly? What do you think that was? I don't know, probably some balloon, or it wasn't a UFO, though. I don't believe in that stuff, and they just don't want to talk about it. There are those people who just bury their head in the sand. They just don't want to look into the subject. So that's what his article is about, and it's a great article. Also, some photographs in Arizona of a configuration of possible UFOs, some light in the sky, lights in the sky. That's really interesting. New York Times also had an article recently. Stephen Bassett, you know, UFOnaut, was talking about this guy, and he, you know, it's incredible. He's been getting some movement going, but in the New York Times, a writer who specializes on new energy and, you know, being the green movement and all of that, wrote a story called A Climate Solution That's Out of This World. And she wrote a very serious article about Stephen Bassett and how he believes that ET technology and the back engineering that is going on in the government can create solutions where we can have clean energy right now if we just disclose and these technologies and what's going on. And she kind of agreed, and she said it was an interesting solution. And, you know, she just did it. It wasn't a thing where she made fun of it. She took a very serious look at this. So that was a great story that came out in the New York Times, of all places. And then Clinton. I might have mentioned this last weekend. I was from Grant Cameron, buddy at presidentialufo.com. I've got a link at my blog talk site on his interview that I did, because he's got a lot of great info. Well, he had been telling me about this great speech that Clinton did where he actually addressed UFOs, and that this speech was done in Hong Kong. And he was working with Neil Gould, who is a UFO researcher in Hong Kong, a great guy. You'll see a lot about him. And if you go look him up on YouTube, he's created some great YouTube videos that are worth watching. But he released this video of a speech, and it took him a long time to get it, of Clinton talking about UFOs, and you can go check this out. I've got a link. Now, he doesn't really say much, to be honest, but the one interesting thing he said is that if they're hiding this information from me, it wouldn't be the first time they've hidden information from presidents. I'm sure there's something to the effect that he's sure they're hiding information from presidents all the time, and that was a really interesting statement for him to make. So there's some of the UFO news in the last week. You know, if you want to sign up, like, to me, that's pretty incredible. You know, when I first got involved with this, I thought UFOs probably aren't in the news that much. You know, maybe you'll see a story here or there. But since I've started for the last few years sending these stories out, you know, it is a slow week when there's only 3 or 4 UFO stories. There are lots of UFO stories in the news, from New York Times down to, you know, Stephenville, Texas, and small papers out there, and you never know what's going to hit and make some really big news. So there's a lot of information out there if you look for it, and signing up for my email list is one good way to stay in the loop with everything going on. Speaking of staying in the loop, we have a wonderful guest tonight who's going to get us up to speed on not only what was going on in her past, but with exopolitics, which is something she's involved with. In fact, I think she's the Durango Exopolitics Examiner now that I remember. But let's bring her on. I'm pushing the button now. Niara, it takes just a couple seconds, and you should be on the air now.
Okay, can you hear me?
I can hear you loud and clear.
Okay, great. So,
am I saying your name right?
Niara, yeah, Niara. And Niara. I'm in the process of kind of shifting my name a little bit. I'm going to be using my first and middle name And I'm going to eventually make a legal change dropping Isley. So it'll be Niara, Torela, and then the Isley will be going away.
Well, it's a very pretty name, Niara. I like the way it looks, too.
Thanks.
Thanks for being on the show.
Yeah. Okay, thank you. Thanks for having me.
Did I have that right? You're the Denver or the Durango Exopolitics Examiner?
Actually, no. I have a Durango Exopolitics blog, and I have a group that I try to have meet regularly where I show films and host some discussion, trying to do education in my local area. But I'm a Denver Extraterrestrial Contact Examiner. That's my title, the Denver Examiner. And I also just taught a class at Fort Lewis College Continuing Ed called UFOs and Extraterrestrials, What Everyone Needs to Know.
Cool.
Kind of a little innocent poke at this need-to-know basis that operates in our government that compartmentalizes everything. So everybody needs to know this stuff.
Yeah, Fort Lewis College, which is not a small college in Colorado. That's one of the bigger ones. And you're out there in Durango, which people, this is in the heart of the mountains out there. It's beautiful out there. Mm-hmm. And isn't that the coldest city in Colorado?
Coldest?
Yeah.
Oh, gosh, I hope not. But it was pretty cold this last year. We really had some weather, but right now it is gorgeous.
Yeah, great. I know somewhere out there is the coldest city in Colorado. I think it might be Durango. I mean, it's one of them. But let's get into your past. So, and I would like to kind of go chronological to begin with. And it's wonderful that you're out about this. And even though I want to go chronological, I guess we'll start actually towards the end. Where what really outed you was sort of a mistake that happened, and I've got a copy of this video, and it's a great documentary, the Dreamland documentary about Area 51 that came out in the 90s. That was the first time you talked about this?
Yeah, it was, and they were supposed to hide my identity, and they did put me in shadow, but they didn't pixelate my image, they didn't disguise my voice. And I was absolutely terrified after that came out because I really didn't want my identity out there. I was still really scared about what I was remembering and what I was talking about on that video. So I stayed absolutely away from all media until just this last year.
Wow.
And then I just thought, well, I have to come out and talk about this. It's just really important, and so here I am. But I was pretty scared back then because people would come up to me years later and they would air the Dreamland documentary, and somebody I worked with would come into work and say, was that you on that UFO show last night? And it's like, yeah. They really did a great job hiding my identity, didn't they? It's water under the dam now, and I'm out with it now. But I did go through quite a few years of real serious fear, having to deal with real serious fear about that.
And I don't think you were the only one from that documentary who was displeased with them not doing a very good job with hiding their identity.
Yeah.
Do you know of that?
Well, I hadn't heard of anybody else being upset about it. I was, trying so hard at the time to, because I just had these memories come back, and I was pretty much reeling with shock because suddenly, it's like the world goes into a negative image, where on one hand you feel like you have the United States of America, mom, baseball, apple pie, and all that great stuff I learned in civics class, and then this. And I thought, holy crap, if this is really true, then the United States of America that I learned about in school doesn't exist. And it completely just turned my life upside down, inside out. And I started on this quest and went to groups and talks and lectures and read books and did everything I could to try to understand what had happened. Because as disturbing as what happened to me was, the fact that it could happen at all in the United States of America was even worse. And so I just had to, like, keep going. And so I looked and looked and couldn't really find the answers I was really looking for. I did collect a lot of data and talk to a few people who had similar experiences. But finally, I just got mad, and I just thought, okay, my life has stood for spiritual inquiry my whole life, you know. So I just thought, oh, the heck with all this UFO stuff. I can't get the answers I want. I'm just going to go back to my meditation and my spiritual practices and so on and so forth. But then the essence of spirituality or a spiritual path is to know yourself deeply. And so finally I had to open up and heal from this. And when I opened back up to it, it wasn't from the standpoint of I have to have answers, but it was from the standpoint of I need to find someone and heal from the emotional fallout of this. And that's
right. Which is wonderful. And yeah, I really want to talk more about that spiritual part to it. But let's start off, and now let's go back into the past. And I'm almost putting on. I do some, actually, I'm a certified hypnotherapist, so I've worked with some people in this arena. So, you know, when I start talking about it, I kind of almost put on my voice, you know, the voice that you use when you take people back, and I got to try not to do that so I don't have the listeners, you know, have some sort of effect. And I did want to mention real quick here, too, for the chat people, the chat wasn't working, so if you refresh the page, the chat should start up, and we've got a lot of cool people in the chat chatting away. So if you were trying to join earlier, you can do that now. But going into the past, when did you get into the Air Force?
I went into the Air Force April 1979, and I've been a good science student my whole life. And so when I tested, I got into the electronics field, radar electronics, and went to Lackland Air Force Base in Texas for basic training, and then on to Keesler Air Force Base in Biloxi, Mississippi for technical training school, and was in auto-track radar. Auto-track radar is a surface to air missile and anti-aircraft artillery radar, and basically what we did in that career field was teach pilots to fly against that radar and use electronic countermeasures to evade the radar, and that increased their survivability rate in wartime fighting situation in the air.
Interesting. So, and during this time, now, from what I understand, you didn't recognize any strangeness, anything weird going on?
No, not at first. Like I said, my first duty station was Nellis Air Force Base in Nevada, and we were part of a group called 554th Range Group, and we were bussed up to either Beatty or Tonopah, and we would work there for a week, and then we were bussed back to Las Vegas and would work in Las Vegas for a week, and it's out there that this all unfolded, actually at Tonopah.
And for people who aren't aware, this is the Area 51 area.
Yeah, in the Nevada test site is Area 51, yeah.
So you're right there where, and then the S4 site, which is a part of Area 51, which is supposed to be another site where there's a lot of secrecy going on. And that's the part where I believe Bob Lazar said he saw the UFOs at.
Yeah, well, the Nevada test site is a really, really large area. It's not just Area 51. It's a really huge area that takes up at least one quarter of the state of Nevada, I would think. And so there's the gunnery ranges and the radar, you know, electronic warfare ranges and the Nevada test site. And it's all this big, huge area. And within that are all these different, you know, areas, you know, like Area 51.
So when you're a radar technician, did you track anything, any UFOs or anything, or hear stories that way?
I heard one story, and I had to work very hard to remember it. It was there was one of my coworkers who was also enlisted, and she was talking to me on the deck of the radar van one afternoon, and she kind of waved her hand out in the desert. She said, somewhere out there they have this place called Dreamland. She said, and she said they're supposed to keep UFOs out there. And she said, I'd sure like to see what they have out there. And, you know, so that was about all I had really heard about it at that time.
Interesting, and that's the early 80s before really anything had been made public about that.
Yeah, this was like January of 1980.
Wow.
But I didn't remember
that.
I had to work pretty hard to remember any details from that period of time at all.
Mm-hmm.
It was like remembering the past and then building memory linkages into that time. It was really not easy to remember at all.
Mm-hmm. So then, really, there wasn't much strangeness that you consciously recognized, even when you left the Air Force. And it was after that you started to recognize something strange had happened or some memory problems. How did that come about?
Another friend of mine, we were talking. He had a metaphysical bookstore in Las Vegas, and this was 1994. And we would talk
How long had you been out of the Air Force at that point?
I had been out of the Air Force since 1983.
Okay.
So it was 1994, and I was talking to my friend, and he just said he noticed some. I've talked to him about this since, and he said he just noticed. He said, you're, like, really sharp, Niara, and there would be all these inconsistencies when you would talk about that time period during your military time. So he sat me down. He said, I want you to tell me about your military time, just like you said tonight, chronologically. So we went through it, you know, from boot camp to training school to Nellis Air Force Base to where I was working. And then I just was brought up short thinking, my God, I can't remember anything from January to March of 1980. I can't remember the most general of details. All I could tell you was I worked at Tonopah Electronic Warfare Range. I was bussed up there every other week for a week and then worked in Vegas. But I didn't remember the people I worked with. I didn't remember the work area or location. I didn't remember anything. Nothing.
Wow.
And it made, with that realization came also this wave of nausea, you know, just feeling sick to my stomach. And so at the first opportunity, I had hypnosis to try to get into that missing time and find out what the heck had happened. I was very concerned because of the feeling that came over me with the recognition.
Did you have,
of the time.
At that point, did you have any sense whatsoever what sort of memories that were missing?
No, I didn't really have a sense of that. I just felt scared about it. You know, because I've got a really good memory, and to have that much time missing and not be able to remember people, like I said, I had to actually try to build memory linkage bridges into that dead zone of memory. So I thought about, okay, I knew these people before I went to Tonopah, and I knew that they were there with me at Tonopah. So then I would think about them, and then I'd try to, you know, chronologically approach into that area where I couldn't remember. And that's how I remembered the one person talking to me about Dreamland. And then I remembered people after that. You know, I had to work really hard at it to build any memory back in there at all, but I didn't get to anything significant. I just started to remember people that I had worked with and some social situations that did not take place out in that work area.
Wow.
That was the
I guess when you eventually, though, you did start to remember strange things.
I had hypnosis with Bud Hopkins in October of 1994. I went to a Whole Life Expo in Las Vegas. And I went to his lecture, and when he got to the question and answer section of his talk, I mentioned about five different anomaly experiences, some from childhood as well, because I am an abductee as well. And so he said, talk to me afterwards, and then we did hypnosis, and then everything else just started being really strange, and I was trying to figure out what had happened, and now here I am today.
Mm-hmm. So what were the nature of those memories?
Well, when he took me into hypnosis, the memory opened up in standing on the deck of the radar van at night. There were saucers in the sky, glowing orange on the bottom. There was one that was fairly close, you know, I'd say, you know, 50, 75 feet away, hanging up in the sky. So I could see it in pretty good detail. And it had a low hum of, like, I describe it the same way every time, so I'll just describe it the same way here. It's like speakers at a rock concert that are on, but they don't have music coming through, but they're just kind
mm-hmm.
of, you know, and there's a crackle every so often. That was the sound that I heard coming from this. We had been given fatigues to wear with no rank insignia and no name tags. We had been forbidden to speak to each other. The crew that was working the radar that night were forbidden to speak to each other beyond what was necessary to run the test. And so we were effectively isolated from each other. Clothing had no identifying marks. And then we were put on a bus and taken to what I believe was Area 51 because of the nature of the medical facility that we were taken to. And we were sat in a waiting room where the lights were turned off in the room. And one by one, they took us into a room over to the side. When it was my turn to go in there, there was a security guard in desert camouflage fatigue standing there with a sidearm at parade rest. And I was told to lay down on a stainless steel examining table. For those of you who have seen the Dreamland special, they did a lot of dramatic stuff. That didn't really happen. It wasn't quite so dramatic as they made it on the video. But I had to lay down on that stainless steel examining table fully clothed. I didn't have to take anything off. Waited there for a while, and I was really, really scared, just growing more terrified by the minute. And then a guy in a white lab coat came in the same door I had come in and walked past the security guard at the foot of the table around to the right up beside my head, saying, stay calm three times. And when he got beside the right side of my head, he brought his hand up and injected me in the side of the neck with something. And at that point, I was so terrified that I came out of the hypnosis spontaneously. I just couldn't take any more. I was
mm-hmm.
immediately out of the hypnosis all on my own. And I looked at Bud and I said, I made this up, right? This can't be real. You know, this is like, I've watched too much science fiction, right? And I kept having it, you know, hoping he would tell me that was what it was, but he didn't, you know. He just said, no, he says, this is the kind of thing that I do hear from time to time. And sorry that it's happened to you. And then I just, the thing is the body, I'm a body-centered life coach. And I've learned
mm-hmm.
the body does not lie. And if I was that terrified, I believe that it's because my body knew that what I had just experienced under hypnosis was true.
Mm-hmm.
And so I went looking for other details that would confirm my details. And I remember at one discussion group or sharing group that I went to, we were sitting in a circle. When it came my turn to talk, I said, well, I think I was taken out in the middle of the night to test radar on UFOs, and of course it wouldn't track them because they were too fast, but then I think we were taken to Area 51 and they did some kind of mind wipe procedure on us. And a guy across the room said, did they stick you in the side of the neck with a needle too?
Wow.
I didn't say that detail because, like I said, I was hoping other people would give details that would confirm mine. And so that was one. And then I've read other things and heard other stories where, you know, little pieces intersect with my own story. And again, I just don't think that I would have felt that terrified if it wasn't real.
And right.
I looked at the False Memory Syndrome Foundation material, and I just think it's... if there are so many of us that are coming forward with incriminating memories about the government or individuals within the government, then I guess somebody felt like they had to create an organization to discredit such individuals. Is about all I can say.
Yeah.
Because before that, hypnosis was regarded as a very valid tool. It was used in courts of law and everything else like that.
Right.
So.
Yeah, I'm a psychology student, and what I found interesting and a bit surprising was when I told a couple of my counselors or the professors, at least one of them especially, you know, that I was certified in hypnotherapy. Oh, well, we do more, you know, scientific studies here. And that was kind of like, well, what do you mean by that? Are you, you know, not validating or trying to say that it doesn't work? And it does seem like people are more skeptical, even though I know that it's so incredibly effective for retrieving memories and resolving issues, which is supposed to be the point of psychology. So it is sad that that happens. What I also think is interesting about your memory and the others who have this, and this plays to the argument that some people have that all abductions are military. They're not really extraterrestrial because the experience is so similar where there's someone standing in an ET experience. There'll be someone standing close to the table, the doctor-type ET coming in and saying, don't be afraid, as they go through these procedures, which often have needles involved as well.
Right. Mm-hmm. Well, I did have subsequent hypnosis to fill in what happened after that. And again, that was very disturbing too. Basically, after the injection, I was drugged down a very, very long flight of stairs. And I was tossed in a room with a one-way observation mirror, you know, mirror on my side and glass on other people's side. And I went through the effects of that injection, pretty much curled up on the floor screaming.
Wow.
And when I was just barely recovering from that, you know, my body had relaxed a little bit, but still shaking. I was dragged out of that room by two security guards and raped by both of them. And I remember that in pretty great detail. I can draw the sofa. I don't remember the rape as much. I remember it happening to me, but it was so traumatic that anything I could do to take my mind off of what was happening to me, I did. So what I did was I memorized the sofa that it happened on. And I can draw that sofa in meticulous detail.
So, and those were, that was an exercise to help you remember?
No, remembering the sofa, no. It was more to just take my mind off what was happening to me.
Oh, I see. I see.
Yeah.
Now, do you feel that that experience, that the rape piece was these guards having fun or actually part of the protocol of whatever they were doing to you?
It was part of the traumatization process to get me to compartmentalize the memory and bury it.
Okay, right. Yeah, because I know big part of mind control because they find, especially with rape victims or especially when it incest type of situations, which is, I believe, why these guys use this stuff is because they've found that victims such as rape victims are able to compartmentalize those memories and pack them up and make them disappear essentially.
Well, there were a lot of other things, too. I had flashbacks, you know, after I had hypnosis, I've had flashbacks of other memories, you know, kind of just kind of pop in there. And some of them include interrogation, where I was threatened with the same treatment or death, and they also threatened my daughter, who at the time was, you know, very small. And just, you know, a lot of other things. I'm writing a book about it, and I'm going to be going into great detail about, you know, everything I think, everything I wonder about, because I feel like it's all important. And somebody out there will read this book, or several somebodies out there will read this book, and they will have had similar things. And then we can start, you know, putting some of the pieces together and try to get a more complete picture. At least I hope so.
Yeah. And it is so awful, you know, and when I first, in my research, discovered that this sort of thing was going on, I meditate, and I had to do a lot of meditation to keep from getting emotional and looking at it for what it is and trying to move past the emotion to look for answers and don't let that, you know, paralyze you so you can't move on, but... it's difficult, you know. I want to say this, and it's hard not to get emotional trying to tell you this, but you know, just so sorry that that happened to you. It's so awful and wrong, and no one should have to go through that type of thing.
I totally understand, and believe me, after I had the second hypnosis sessions, the first session was 1994. It took me till 2003. To get to the point where I could do more hypnosis and then find somebody I trusted to do it with. So it was a long time. And I remember after I had that hypnosis in March of 2003, and I remember coming back home and just sitting curled up on my sofa, staring into space, thinking, okay, now how do I live with these kind of memories, knowing the kind of brutality that human beings can inflict on other human beings? You know, I really didn't know, but I knew that suicide wasn't the way out because I kind of confronted that much earlier in life. I nearly did away with myself then, and for spiritual reasons, it's a really bad idea to commit suicide. I didn't have a failed attempt. I just sat and thought it through, and I thought, okay, you know, you're not your body because you've been out of your body. So if your body's laying there dead, where are you going to be? And when I started thinking about it from that standpoint and from the study I'd done on near-death experiences up to that point, I thought, holy moly, you better stay in your body and work this out no matter how hard it is. So I knew suicide wasn't a way out to return to 2003 sitting on that sofa. So I knew that that wasn't it. But then a unique opportunity came to me with a healer here in Durango. And I got together with her, and I said, I have a lot of strange stuff to tell you, I said, but I really need to work on it. And one of the other things that really pushed me was Bush Cheney getting into the White House and some of the things that they were pulling, you know, like the Patriot Act and the erosion of our constitutional rights and the erosion of our basic freedoms and rights in this country. And I had a real worsening of my PTSD because I definitely suffered from post-traumatic stress disorder from these experiences. And so I went and I talked to this healer about it, and she didn't judge me. She didn't do anything. She just helped me through it. And she had a lot of different skills. I think somatic experiencing was one. Hakomi was another. She just worked with me to help me feel my feelings to completion. And then I was able to really calm down the post-traumatic stress disorder. And it didn't really trouble me too much, so much anymore.
Yeah.
And,
so it's like
go ahead.
Well, and we'll get into this part, but it's almost like this, it's this double whammy with people such as who have had the experiences such as you've described, or even, you know, any woman who's been raped in the military, the cover-up pieces, where there's one side where people don't want to hear it. There's the other side that this has happened, and, you know, there's people denying that it happened, and so finding the people to help people like this is what's difficult. And that's what I find so compelling to get involved with this, especially also with the people who have had the abduction experiences, that people don't believe them. They're afraid to talk about it without sounding crazy. The government doesn't acknowledge that this has happened to them. And so there's no place for them to go for help, which is definitely what people need. So thank goodness for people like your friend who helped
you.
I'm
hoping to be able to help people myself now, because I am a body-centered life coach, and I'm capable of being with people and coaching them through just staying with their feelings so that that feeling cycle has a chance to complete in their body. Because what happens is it plays, and you push it away, and it doesn't get a chance to complete the cycle.
Mm-hmm.
So basically what you need is you need somebody to sit there with you and allow you to feel what you're feeling and experience what you're feeling and keep you with it, encourage you to just stay with the experience until it completes its energy cycle in your body. And then, you know, after enough of that kind of work, then you can start to move beyond it and have some peace.
Yeah. So moving beyond that portion for now, there was also during this period an extraterrestrial component?
Yes.
Beyond the UFOs?
Yeah, there was. And I had, you know, abductions from childhood. I feel kind of some kinship, even though I haven't talked with him. Maybe someday I will be able to talk with him. Dan Sherman, who wrote Above Black.
Yeah, I've read that, which is interesting.
Yeah.
He was another radar tech. And if anybody hasn't read that, Above Black, you can go online and find it and download it for free. And this is a gentleman who was in the Air Force, and his job was a radar tech, but he did it a lot differently than other people getting information.
It was also,
actually, it was intelligent.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
He was an intuitive communicator. And there are several points in his story that intersect with points in mine. And he was told, I felt strongly that I was pulled for that particular detail that I got entangled in because I was an abductee, and someone in the government knew that I was an abductee. And he was told in the Pentagon, I believe, that his mother was abducted and he was adjusted in the womb. And I just have the strongest feeling that that's the same case with me.
Mm. Have you heard of Melinda Leslie?
Melinda, yes, I have talked to her. I talked to her this last, the International UFO Congress in Laughlin this past year. In February, I met her and talked with her for quite a while, actually.
Yeah, she was the one on UFO Not Radio, another blog talk radio show. That's on Sunday evenings, and she had similar stories. But yeah, and if you can continue on in that extraterrestrial component that was during that time.
Yeah, that's interesting. That's a little strange for me. I had it from early childhood, and it was, I'm doing a lot of because a lot of it was, sexual, even from early childhood, and I know this is something that really needs to be talked about because our culture here on Earth is so circumspect or repressed when it comes to talking about sexuality, but I think this is something that needs to be talked about more. So there just seemed to be a conditioning from early childhood with sexual kinds of things happening. And then later on, there was a hybrid. Go ahead.
Okay. So do you mean medical procedures or even beyond that?
The first thing that I remembered happening was I was a little girl, and I had had a dream that Bud Hopkins thought was kind of suspect as being a cover for an encounter. And during that dream, I was stretched on a table with these grays around me with the big eyes. and they had something on my stomach that in my, you know, four-year-old state of mind, I called it a stomach presser. I didn't know what else to call it. but when I came out of the hypnosis and I was, you know, back in my adult thinking mind again, I thought, you know, gosh, that reminds me of an ultrasound. So it's like they were doing an ultrasound of the whole abdominal area. And then there was, you know, some kind of sexual touching and things like that, even from early childhood, almost like I was being conditioned. And then later on in life, I think there was this hybrid that that I was with intimately many times. And I think that I would get pregnant, and then in the first trimester of the pregnancy, they would come and pick me up and take the fetus. And the reason I believe that is because all through my young adult childbearing years, every time I got near a doctor, they'd ask if I was pregnant. And I'd say, no, I don't think so. I haven't been with anybody. And some of them would take a pregnancy test just to be sure. And then when I had my tubes tied, because I didn't, you know, after having two children here on Earth, I had my tubes tied. And the doctor went in under a local anesthetic, so I was awake for the procedure. And he said, my God, your whole abdominal cavity is full of adhesions. Have you had other procedures? And I said, no. And so he really remarked on that. And then the doctor that did my hysterectomy a year ago also remarked on all the adhesions in the abdominal cavity. And under hypnosis, I found that in the first trimester of pregnancy, that the ETs had gone in with a needle through the belly button and harvested the fetuses from the uterus that way. And that would explain those adhesions.
Now, when was this period of time with the hybrid? About what age?
I think it started right after my first menstrual cycle. It's another strange little thing. The first time I was with an Earth man, there was no virginity to lose. And he was kind of questioning me, saying, are you sure you're a virgin? Are you sure you haven't been with anybody else? And I said, no, I haven't been with anybody else, because I didn't have any memory of what was going on the spaceships. So I was, like, confused, and he was confused. And then again, when I had hypnosis and realized that I pretty much had this ongoing relationship with this hybrid, then that became clear as well, why there didn't seem to be any virginity to lose when I was with my first Earth man. So.
And what made you feel that this person was a hybrid, non-Earth person?
Yeah. He looked very similar to a gray, except he had, you know, thin, very, very thin, you know, strands of wispy white hair growing on his head. And he had large eyes, not as large as the grays, but they were very large, and they were vivid, vivid blue, you know, a blue iris, and then there was a pupil, and they were just vivid blue and large. And he had a very small mouth, you know, there was just a hint of lips on the mouth and a very small, you know, blunt nose.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, very interesting. I've heard of very similar types being described before. And then you said you had experiences with grays, and describe what they look like, what yours look like.
Well, some were short, some were tall. They just seemed, you know, to have this really smooth gray skin and these really large, dark eyes. And I seemed to have some kind of ability to see through. They would project screen memories at me, like when I was a little girl. They would project my sister being there with me, my older sister. I had an older sister 12 years older than me, who was one of my, you know, was pretty much a primary caregiver along with my mom. And they would project her image at me. And I would see it, and I would think, but my sister's not here. And so I would know that it was not real, and it would fade away, and then I'd see the gray who was projecting the image with the large eyes. And their skin was a pale gray, from what I remember. Pretty pale, kind of ashy.
Were their eyes slanted?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, definitely slanted. And so they would project these screen memories, and I would kind of see through it. And when I was a little girl, I learned that they would think to me telepathically, and I learned that I could think back to them. And sometimes I would get really mad because I didn't like what they were doing. And so I would think thoughts about picking them up and breaking them in half because I knew that really bothered them. And then it seemed like somewhere along the line, the nature of my contacts changed from being scary and kind of, you know, being controlled to feeling like I was part of the culture on the ship and allowed more freedom.
So, and when you, talking about that, when you would think of picking them up and this was a thought and breaking them over your knee, that had an effect on them.
Yeah. The effect that it had was not so great for me because they actually just made sure that I was kind of secured down and couldn't move. It was, you know, that was the consequence of that was I couldn't get up and move around. But then I kind of got over it, and I started to understand that to me they were just trying to save their species. And I just thought, I guess that's okay that they're trying to save their species.
A couple questions from the chat room. From Kathy in the chat room. First, do you think that there's more than one type of alien?
Oh, yeah, for sure.
Did you experience different types? Like, you did explain that there were shorter and then there were taller. Were those different types, you think?
I think they were different types. I read Lissa Royal's book, Visitors from Within, and that's been the most helpful book that I have read about.
Which book is that?
Visitors from Within by Lissa Royal and Keith Priest. And it was very, very good. It went into the sexual stuff in a way that helped me to, you know, integrate my experiences. And it was just really good and explained that there were different groups of grays. And I really think that there are. I think there are some grays who have self-serving agendas. And then there are others who are less self-serving and more kind and more careful of the people that they pick up. So when the nature of my contacts changed, I was wondering if maybe I had started having contacts with a different group when things seemed to ease up and there seemed to be generally more kindness. Although it was still kind of a cold clinical setting, but there just seemed to be more more kindness and more just a nicer experience, I guess.
She wanted to know if they gave you any information on what they think of humans.
Well, the first thing that popped into my mind was that we're not very aware. You know, our whole sense of reality is so completely entrenched in the third dimension that we don't even recognize our own multidimensionality. We're like a radio station that's tuned to a very narrow bandwidth, and so that's where our attention stays. And there's all these other stations on the dial that we could be tuning into if we just knew how. But we're just focused on the 3D bandwidth.
I've heard it described exactly like you described it now, like a radio.
And then
what about your thoughts on them, how you feel about them? You kind of talked a little bit how your experience has changed from in the beginning and after the experiences changed. How did you feel about them?
I think I got to the point where I liked them. I felt almost like I was part of their culture at night, mm-hmm. you know, during the times that I was with them. It was like being part of a different culture, and it was fine with me. I think I got to see some of my children. I don't think too many of them lived. And I think I for some reason, I feel like I had as many as 17. Mm. And but I don't think many of them lived. I think at least one daughter lived, and probably a couple others.
Mm-hmm. But, do you think that the experimentation didn't work, or why do you think that they all didn't live?
I just think that the blend of the genetics was iffy to begin with, and if the genetics didn't combine properly at fertilization, then, you know, it just didn't work. Mm-hmm. And I did have feelings for the hybrid who fathered the children. And I think mm-hmm. that he had some kind of feelings for me, but he was fairly unemotional. But he did, mm-hmm. you know, sometimes touch me, like put a hand on my stomach or put a hand on my hip and would be looking into my eyes. And I did feel that there was some kind of connecting energy there.
Mm-hmm.
Glad that at least that much was there, because otherwise it would have been really tough, and it was tough enough.
Yeah.
And I just wonder sometimes if people have had abductions and had that kind of contact, if it really follows them into their earthly life and causes sexual difficulties of one kind or another, either extreme mm-hmm. repression or sexual addiction. Because it's really strange. It's like, here you're having sex, and sex feels really good, and the way I explain it is, so that foot that feels good is on the accelerator pushing that to the floor, because that feels good. You want to go with that feeling. But then you're with a person who doesn't look anything like a human being, a regular human mm-hmm. being. So the other foot is pushing your emotional experience on the brake pedal all the way to the floor. So it's like having one foot on the accelerator and one foot on the brake all the way to the floor, both feet, you know.
Right.
If you can kind of get what I'm talking about there.
Mm-hmm.
So it causes issues where you might feel good in having a sexual experience with, say, your earth partner, but then there's another part of you that's holding back because, oh, God, it's not okay to feel good. You know, because it might be strange, you know, or something.
Yeah.
So I'm just wondering about that, and it's not easy to talk about, you know, sex and stuff that's so personal.
Right.
But if I do talk about it, and other people have had that experience, then maybe it will help bring them some peace. You know. Maybe
yeah, and
I want to shine a light in there and help them. You know.
Yeah, and I want to thank you for going there, and I do agree with you that it's important because many of the people I've worked with, they have had issues that with their other relationships due to these experiences. And, you know, to share a little bit about when I first got involved with UFO research, I was skeptical about the abduction experience. And then I started having a lot of people come to me sharing their experiences. And then I found the similarities, you know, between all of these experiences, like yours. There were sexual aspects and the hybridization, and I always find, and why I ask how they feel about these extraterrestrials or these things that, you know, they feel are doing this to them. How they feel about them is always very interesting. And many times I found that it's either a positive regard, like you came to, or also very similar that they're doing their job, they're doing what they have to do. I don't feel bad towards them, but I certainly don't like the situation type of feeling.
It's much more difficult to deal with other human beings abusing you because they don't mm-hmm. have the excuse, you know. They're not mm-hmm. an alien species traveling over the earth picking up specimens and studying them. You know, they don't have that excuse for the abuse that they inflict. So I'll tell you, I was pretty enraged by that, and I had to really work through the rage as well as the fear. And then the healing process, part of the healing process has been to step step, take a big step back and look at the cosmic reason. So from a soul, from a soul level, from a spiritual level, I believe that I came into this life to experience certain things. And I believe that I chose this lifetime with all of its experiences, traumatic or otherwise, to, and that trauma was a catalyst for awakening. It was my catalyst to really shake me awake, so to speak. And and so stepping back and looking at it from that standpoint has been really helpful, because then it's like, oh, I came in to do this exactly what I've done and to awaken. And the awakening process has been so marvelous that I look back now and I can't really regret any of my experiences anymore. You know, I mean, I've come that far. I feel that healed now, but I don't really have any regret about anything, and wouldn't change it. Because now that I've worked through the fear, amazing things are happening. You know, I mean, my consciousness is lighting up in a way I could never, ever have imagined. My intuition is working better. I'm seeing so many things so much more clearly. And I'm doing my best to pass those learnings and those teachings on. And it's a really a remarkable experience to be able to set the fear aside and expand into that whole new space.
I'm going to write that note because I want to get back to that. On the you said that you they were trying to save their species. In what way and what gives you that impression?
Well, my impression is, and I think this is borne out by other research, is that I feel that they did away with sexual reproduction for some reason, whether it's the reasons given in Lissa Royal's book, Visitors from Within, or some other reasons. They decided to do away with sexual reproduction and reproduced by cloning. And so over time, cloning creates problems. A species will lose its biogenetic diversity by just cloning the same individuals over and over again. And we're seeing that on this planet with cheetahs. Cheetahs, there's only a few individuals left, and they will not recover as a species because they've lost enough of their gene pool that they don't have enough biogenetic diversity with the remaining individuals to propagate their species again. I think it's just so with the grays or the zetas. They don't have enough genetic biodiversity, and they need to reintroduce that genetic biodiversity by using our genetic material back into their species. And the way that species procreate, that do sexual procreation, there's continual recombining of all kinds of different genetic material and traits. There's recessive and dominant genetics, and they all combine in different ways over and over again in sexual reproduction. So in order for their species to survive, they need to reintegrate sexuality back into their species. So not only are they using sexuality to, with the hybrids that they have to continue to propagate the species and reintroduce the sexuality again, but as you're having a sexual experience on the ship, they are there studying sexual response, the emotional components, the hormonal components, all the feeling aspects of it, the responses. They're studying every bit of it because they want to correctly reintegrate it into their species. And that's just my opinion. Yeah, but it just seems to be borne out by what I experienced.
Well, and there, in my experience, others that shared very similar, if not completely exact, opinions that you do. Another aspect that some people say is that they have, at some unconscious or possibly a soul level or possibly even in-betweens or in prior lives, have agreed to help out these guys to save their species. What do you think of that concept?
I think that that's really true. I think each one of us comes in with a soul contract of things that we agree to before we come in, and we might protest quite, you know, loudly once we're here and we don't remember the soul contract, and we say, well, I didn't agree to this, blah, blah, blah. But more than likely, you did agree to it before you came into this life. And that's a much more difficult thing for people to swallow if they don't believe in reincarnation. And they, mm-hmm. you know, and they don't have a sureness of life beyond the body. So I can understand how those folks would really yell and complain about it and not want to look at the soul contract idea. But for me, it really works because I don't want to go through life being a victim. And so the best way for me to not be a victim of anything is to take full responsibility for, at some level, accepting that these experiences were going to be mine in this lifetime.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, an interesting aspect, Dr. Leo Sprinkle, who's kind of a mentor of mine and the reason I've gotten into this stuff primarily and continue to get more into this area, he was one of the pioneers in this arena doing hypnotherapy and taking these people serious for decades. And he found in his studies that the vast majority of people having these experiences believe in reincarnation, and the percentage being much, much higher than the general population, especially for back when he started this research.
Yeah, well, I think that's because people having extraordinary experiences and or trauma, it cracks open their consciousness. It really opens them up in a way. It's kind of a shaman's journey, where a shaman in a tribe, usually he becomes the shaman or she becomes the shaman because she has an extraordinary experience, an out-of-body experience, a near-death experience, or some kind of initiatory experience that was really difficult that broke open and expanded the consciousness. And then that person can see into other worlds, and then they come back, and they have gifts to share with their tribe. So it's really the same kind of process at work here. And I want to tell all your listeners that if you're one of those people that's having difficulty with your abductions or your contacts, and you're angry about it, and you don't buy this particular theory, I understand. It's very difficult. And if you're angry, that's okay. The thing to do is to honor your human feelings and yet allow yourself to step back a little bit each time and try to look at the larger cosmic perspective. Because basically what you want someday is peace. You don't want to continue to be angry and fearful. You want peace. And the only thing that's going to bring you peace is to process the emotions through to completion and look at it from the largest perspective you can.
And one thing that I found is important in even researching this field is to overcome fear. I know for me it was a big deal to meditate and these experiences of what if I came across an ET, or I do all sorts of paranormal research. So to what if I came across these other paranormal type of entities and things like what if this situation. And I think that a lot of researchers become limited because they cannot conquer their fear. But the ones that do, the individuals such as yourself having experiences, and the researchers who overcome their fear are able to do a lot more. And help more. So I love that. I think that aspect is just incredible. And I've also found that from people who acknowledge their experiences, I guess it's just like that in life, though. Whenever we acknowledge what we're afraid of and the things we don't want to face, once we face those things and overcome them, the growth is just amazing. And I've seen people just after a short period of time of sharing, or acknowledging and working through their experiences, being able to share such incredible information and come to such incredible wisdom, that aspect is also fascinating.
Yeah, it really is. You know, I mean, it's an extraordinary experience to have, maybe not one that we would consciously choose from a 3D lifetime perspective, but if you have had that experience, then I would urge people to feel the feelings, to heal, and to look for the gifts of the experience in their own life.
Yeah, there's someone in the chat room now who's talking about having to struggle with the feeling that, you know, their experiences are evil.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Another person had an interesting question, too, that I wanted to ask you about. She's having trouble understanding their own species. In other words, if they're integrating with our species, are they going to lose their species and become a little bit of us, a brand new type of species?
Yeah, yeah, that's going to be the end result.
Uh-huh.
And the name for that species, according to Lissa Royal, is Esasani.
Hmm, interesting.
So
and now you've moved beyond. Uh-huh, go ahead, sorry.
Oh, I just was going to say the Esasani will look more like us. They'll have qualities from the grays, you know, like larger eyes, but they'll look
mm-hmm.
more like us, more like a good blend.
Hmm.
So, another question.
A couple other questions. Now that you made me think of another one, did you ever have experiences with human-looking extraterrestrials, people who you thought were extraterrestrials that were human-looking?
Yeah, that's an interesting question to get into, and I'd like to do some more hypnosis around that because I feel now that I've set the fear aside and my intuition has expanded, I feel like for many years now that I travel in the astral body to a huge ship somewhere out in orbit where I attend what I call Cosmic University. And mm-hmm. I have met people down here here and there on planet Earth that I'll meet them and it's like we know each other. We take mm-hmm. one look at each other and it's like, oh my God, I know you, or I've dreamed about you, and we usually become really good friends. And I know mm-hmm. that we both know that we know each other from Cosmic University, and that's just my name for it. But I feel like mm-hmm. I learn things there in a particular way in which when that knowledge is needed, I'll awaken to it here.
Mm-hmm.
And some of the information that is really coming through strongly now is to teach people about emotions versus feelings and teach people what emotions are, what they are in the body, what they're for, because emotions actually enhance our survivability as a species. But when people understand, you know, how they can use emotions, generate emotions to manipulate us, then it becomes not such a good thing. And when we're in the grip of strong emotion, like hate or fear or anger, then our intuition doesn't work. Our sixth sense does not work too well. And so when you put that in the perspective of what we get on the media with dishing up fear about swine flu or dishing up fear, you know, we saw so much fear pushed at us over the television and radio with the Bush administration, you know, mm-hmm. and they do it on purpose because it keeps us off balance. It keeps us from accessing our internal intuitive knowing.
Mm-hmm.
And they want to keep us away from that at all costs. You know, they want to keep us off balance with emotion.
Yeah. Another great person, another real idol of mine, Dr. John Mack, who was a psychologist from Harvard in this field. The very last article he wrote before he unfortunately was hit by a drunk driver was very similar to that. And it was and critical of the current administration, at that time the Bush administration, pushing that fear. And he was equating it to Nazi Germany and the similar type of things and that negative effects it has on a population. It was a pretty good article.
Yeah, well, I know a lot about dealing with fear. And I'll tell you, it burns people out after a while. You can only dish up so much of it, and people can only take so much of it. And then there's this spiritual thing that can happen for a person where, you know, I'm so tired of being afraid, I'm just going to surrender whatever it is in me that I need to surrender so I don't have to feel afraid anymore. And then what happens is you're kind of caught by the divine, and you relax, and then suddenly your intuitive senses come online. And you realize, oh, wow, this is really special, you know. But fear can only go so far. It burns itself out. It burns itself out in individuals, and it burns itself out in the population. It's like crying wolf all the time. Eventually it loses its charge. And so if you want to look from the largest cosmic perspective here, what we have is a government that dishes up fear and it does all this stuff, but what it's doing is actually applying evolutionary pressure to the population, because 2012 is coming up here real soon, and I don't make any claims to know what's going to happen. But if it is the end of a grand cycle, as is talked about in the raw material or the law of one material, and there's supposed to be a huge evolutionary leap or expansion of consciousness for humanity, then the pressure that the Bush administration and other individuals in government or groups in government are dishing up is probably the exact evolutionary pressure that we need as a species to go supernova in our consciousness very shortly.
Yeah, speaking of meditation a lot in this interview, you know, I used to meditate a lot on sending love towards George Bush and to Cheney because they were the most difficult people for me to love.
Yes.
But I have heard a lot of people lately, very spiritual speakers, talking about how, you know, a good reason to send them love with that, because they did open people's eyes to a lot of this stuff, to fear and overcoming fear. And, you know, a lot, I think because of that, a lot of it used to be back when you were having your experiences and realizing what had happened to you in the Air Force, people thought there's no way the Air Force, our government, would do such evil things. But nowadays, after hearing all the lies, people are much more open to accept that possibility.
Oh, I found that too. People that wouldn't give me the time of day to listen to my story 10 years ago, the last 8 years, they started listening a lot more. They still didn't like what they were hearing, and they might shut it off at some point, but they were much more willing to listen. And the last 8 years of the Bush-Cheney administration has had such an awakening effect on the population of this country and maybe even the world, that those of us doing this work to educate about UFOs and expanded realities and, you know, the whole ball of wax that is the UFO enigma, we really need to take this opportunity to really put that education out there even more while we have the opening and consciousness to do so.
Mm-hmm. Another person in the chat who had experiences in the past said now they mostly have dreams, and that their dreams are telling them that a disclosure will be coming soon, where people will be open about this subject. Do you feel similar?
I do. I do think that it's going to come really soon. We just had that great article that you mentioned that was done in the New York Times with Stephen Bassett and talking about the release of extraterrestrial energy sources to fuel that crisis. I just taught that class at Fort Lewis College, and it was a paradigm-busting class because people come in and they think, well, I've seen the UFO stuff on TV and everything, but it's all kind of distant from them. You know, I showed them really, really good connect-the-dots kind of material, and maybe some of them will go away and go back into denial, but I think I presented the material in such a way that people will look at it and they'll think, whoa, I don't have the luxury not to believe in this anymore. This is really real. You know, it's really been illustrated to me how real it is. And it's also been illustrated to me that on a very practical level, we need the release of this technology so that we can save our planet and turn things around for our environment. You know, so it's not just about lights in the sky. It's really about addressing very needed practical concerns on this planet that's one thing that I think is going to fuel disclosure. And I'm really, really, for me, it's a personal mission. I'm very passionate about getting out there with it now because I have my little piece of the puzzle, and I want to share that and educate and do everything I can to get this out there and to draw all the information together in such a way that people look at it and see, yes, something really is going on. The more aware people are and the more the numbers of people are aware, the more this can happen. And I think disclosure has to be a grassroots effort as much as we want to have it come from the government. More and more people like me come forward and tell their stories. For every person that does it, we pry a little more power out of the military-industrial complex. We pry a little more power out of their fingers, and we put it back in the hands of the people where it belongs.
Yeah. Well, and that's why I'm excited about what Jeff Beckman's doing, and I really want to help him as much as possible get the signatures for his ballot initiative, because, like you said, that's grassroots, you know. That's
Yeah.
Hitting the streets and getting the people involved.
Yeah.
So, and, you know, another great thing that I've really loved about our talk here tonight is that it shows a lot of times people will say, oh, researchers without any sort of evidence are saying that there's a hybridization, and they're saying that there's these soul contracts, and they're saying... But it's not really that. In my experience, it's not been, well, through my training, but also through, I was a journalist in school, and I've always been careful not to lead people. And it's been my experience that it's the people with ET experiences or who have feel they have those experiences, they're the ones that are giving out this information. They're the ones who are sharing these ideas, as opposed to anybody pushing these ideas upon them. Even people I've talked to who have had nothing to do with the UFO community, they don't know anything about it. They will share these same concepts and ideas because I'm the first person that they've ever talked to about their experiences they don't even like to talk or look at UFO shows because it scares them. But that's where all of these same ideas are coming from, and I find that just extraordinary.
Well, you don't have to look at it, you know, in the spiritual, you know, what some people would call woo-woo stuff, you know. Yeah, all
right.
You have to do is look at science. Look at the popularity of the movie What the Bleep Do We Know. Quantum physics is an exciting branch of physics that's really bridging metaphysics and spirituality into the realm of science. It's that leaping beyond, it's that ability to think as a multidimensional being and realize that for all the years where science was supposed to stand for objective, empirical observation and study, quantum science now shows us that there really, it can't be anything, any such thing as empirical or objective observation, because the observer affects what they're observing. And so if that's the case, then what we need to do is we need to educate more people about that, because a lot of people in the UFO field, I find, they accept that craft are multidimensional and that they come and go from different dimensions, but they're still thinking third dimensionally. They're not taking this new science into account. So what we need to do is think multidimensionally. We are multidimensional beings. We really are. I mean, if all these dimensions exist, as they're postulating now in string theory and the new physics, if all of that is true, which I believe it is, and the UFOs or the extraterrestrials are demonstrating a mastery of that knowledge, then what we need to do is we need to be thinking more multidimensionally and expand that bandwidth beyond the 3D bandwidth and take in more of it. And quantum mechanics show us the way to do that.
Yeah, I agree 100%, and I'm so interested in science getting into that whole consciousness and the quantum physics, and it's just so fascinating, and it's wonderful to get involved with. But we are out of time. This has been a wonderful talk. Thank you very much for joining me on the show, and I can't wait to work with you more. I'm happy that you live in the same state I am in, and I look forward to meeting you in person hopefully soon.
Okay, yeah, I'll be in Denver the end of this month, Memorial Day weekend. Okay.
Wonderful. Well, thank you very much. It's been a great show. We've got Jeff Peckman up next time. I've got 5 seconds, so everybody have a wonderful evening.